training people who cannot benefit from the training is an enormous waste of money. So it might look unequal to focus on younger men without children for richer families, but that's not wasted money. So you always have to think about the counterfactual. If the counterfactual is offering training to people who don't benefit, then it's better to just focus on those who benefit.
Welcome to Development Dialogues, a podcast series bringing together experts from research and policy to answer questions that are key to addressing today's most complex global development challenges. We'll discuss how the latest research in development economics can inform strategies to fight poverty, reduce inequality, and drive inclusive economic growth. Development Dialogues is a collaboration between Yale's Economic Growth Center and VoxDev. Hello, and welcome to Development Dialogues. I'm your host, Catherine Cheney. In this episode, we're diving into a big question at the heart of efforts to create better job opportunities in low and middle income countries. What does it really take to make job skills programs work? Vocational training is often seen as a silver bullet for unemployment and poverty, but does the evidence support that view? Why do so many training programs fail to lead to real job opportunities? And are we asking too much of these programs, or maybe the wrong questions entirely? Joining us are three experts who bring rigorous research and real-world experience to these questions. Oriana Bandiera is the Sir Anthony Atkinson Professor of Economics at the London School of Economics, where she also directs the Hub for Equal Representation. Her research explores how economic policies and institutions shape labor markets and development outcomes. Oriana delivered the 34th Simon Kuznets Memorial Lecture at Yale on the topic of development and the organization of labor. Stefano Caria is a professor of economics at the University of Warwick. He uses experimental methods to investigate how to make labor markets work better for the poor. Stefano was also senior editor for a VoxDev Lit on barriers to search and hiring in urban labor markets. And Munshi Suleiman is the director of research at the Brack Institute of Governance and Development and a professor in the Master of Development Studies program at Brack University. He brings a unique lens from decades of applied work in organizations like Brack and Save the Children, focusing on labor markets, poverty, and the practical realities of designing and scaling programs. Together, we'll debate what vocational training can and can't achieve, whether we're training people for jobs that don't exist, and how to design more realistic, equitable, and effective programs in a changing world of work. Let's dive in. Oriana, Stefano, Munshi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
So if we want vocational training to lead to meaningful employment, we need to think beyond just training and make sure workers can access real job opportunities. And in this conversation, we'll talk about how that can be done. Vocational training is often seen as a solution to unemployment, but to what extent does the evidence support this assumption?
From the evidence point of view, vocational training is a perfect example of a mixed bag. There is evidence of positive effects, there is evidence of zeros, and most importantly, these very imprecise estimates.
On average, though, it's important to stress that I think the average program actually has a positive impact. So this is important. Sometimes you get lost in the debate. Maybe depending on which meta-analysis you look at, we are talking of 5, 6, 7 percentage points increases in employment. That's sizable, although by no means is the kind of full solution to the employment problem the governments in low and middle income countries are looking for. So I guess it's also a mixed bag in terms of, yes, there are meaningful impacts on employment on average, heterogeneous, but on average meaningful. But no, these impacts are not enough in isolation to solve the employment problem in the way the governments would like to solve it.
And there is actually a lot of heterogeneity also in terms of how many governments think that vocational training is the solution. Because in some cases, it's part of social protection. In other cases, it's not. Some governments offer free vocational training to most people. Some governments don't. And some NGOs, as Munshi will tell us, he knows better than we do.
So maybe one clarification on the type of vocational training we're talking about and then sort of my read of the evidence. I guess when you're talking about this general vocational training, interventions, training, these are sort of general skills that can be acquired maybe through 3 to 6 months of training, either as apprentice or short certificate course, not necessarily 2 or multi-year diploma courses. Those are typically not the ones evaluated in this body of evidence. And when it comes to the general evidence, I guess, as Oriana started, this is the mixed bag. And that's where we hit economists with two hands, because, you know, this has positive impact, but with these and ifs and buts. And there are lots of ifs and buts. So that makes it difficult as a clear policy message and requires a lot of finer details of where exactly, what context, which types of market failure we're trying to address and all of that, as well as who are we selecting and how are we delivering, and all the details come in.
I think also fundamentally, we are not quite clear as to the specific market failure that training addresses. So we have a lot of good, actually, reduced form estimates of what training does in context 1 and context 2 and context 3. But I guess we have a less clear understanding of why we need training in the first place. So is it that workers do not have the liquidity to finance this training? So there is a almost poverty trap story where people just cannot acquire a certain amount of human capital that is needed to access a modern sector of the economy. Is it that firms are unable to provide this training because it's either too costly, they don't know how to do it, or maybe they're afraid that they're going to lose the workers to the competition if they train them? All of these are fundamental questions. They will also clarify whether we need training in the first place. And I guess our understanding of these deeper conceptual questions is unfortunately more shallow than our understanding of just the reduced form effects of training interventions.
Oriana, I want to ask you specifically about what Stefano just mentioned in terms of poverty traps, because that came up in your Kuznets lecture.
If somebody has talent and this talent requires training to be leveraged, our training is expensive. So if somebody was born very poor and very talented, if they cannot access the right training, they will never use that talent and they will remain poor. And so it's a self-fulfilling cycle. So I think the evidence that I mentioned in the Kuznets lecture was with physical assets. Some women are very good at rearing cows, but they cannot afford to buy a cow. Hence, they stay poor and they can never afford to buy a cow. This is exactly the same principle, but with human capital. I could be a fantastic welder, but I cannot afford to take a welding course, and so I will remain a domestic servant for life.
Many of the governments we're talking about are low and middle income countries where part of the decision-making structure is donors. Where do donors come into the mix in terms of how they define the problem or how they measure the effectiveness of vocational training?
When it comes to thinking of a solution, at least in the NGO world, we often do this problem tree and then try to find out solution tree. So what are the problems? The problems are usually the youth. They don't have any work, so they are not in employment, training, etc. So that is the problem. So we need to give them employment. How do we do that? Well, they don't have the skill, so let's fix that. And then sometimes we go a step forward and like, okay, are the skills that we're training, are these marketable or not? It's quite common. We see that all sorts of vocational skills training, like in Bangladesh, for instance, with these refugees, Rohingya influx coming in. For youth, what do we do? What sort of training can we do? We are doing lots of training, but of course, they don't have the rights to work. So in some ways, there is no skill that they can market beyond whatever they're able to do. As the first line of intervention that we can think of, it does come out as one of the things that we should be doing. Seems like a good idea if you ask youth, what do you want to do? Because, you know, we often try to do it in a participatory way. So they know that they don't have the skills. Maybe they can do something. If they had the skills, they want to do this. But then once we do the intervention, generally what we see is, well, they sometimes have a slightly higher employment, usually for 6 months to a year. And most of the times it dissipates. And one of the conclusions is it's not addressing any of the underlying market conditions that can really lift them up to a different level. Another big problem with the evidence that we generally have is quite often I think of the Achilles heels for all sorts of vocational training intervention is what is happening in the market, like the displacement. We may see a little bit of positive effect. Is it coming at a cost of someone else being displaced who may not be part of the study? Or maybe this is a little net employment generation. We hardly have any evidence on that.
I have some questions for you, Munshi. To what extent do you think that training is popular with donors because it's relatively cheap? Because we know that programs to get people out of extreme poverty, the graduation program is very effective, but it's perceived to be very expensive. Although if you see it in an optic of investment, it's not expensive at all. So do you think that there is this sense that training is seen like a quick fix? It seems like a good deal because per person is not that expensive.
The cost does play some role, but some of the training program I have seen cost often as much as the ultra poor graduation program, like even $400, $500. In Somalia, I've seen this cost way more, sometimes even $1,000 for 6 months of training on welding. Cost probably plays a role, but often it's being able to directly connect that we are doing this intervention and these are the people who are receiving it. So it kind of gives us a sense of clarity on, hey, where the money is being spent, some transparency. Whereas in a market level intervention, it gets complicated. Like, how do we don't know who's the beneficiary?
Because often if you have market failures, you need market level interventions.
I wanted to continue on this question about cost because, Stefano, I think this connects with your work on the Vox DevLit on barriers to search and hiring in urban labor markets. And one of the points you made in talking about this research is that the cost associated with job search is much cheaper than training.
As Diana was saying, there are asset transfer interventions that tend to be very expensive. Then you have training interventions, and they are cheaper compared to asset transfer interventions, but they're still a few hundred dollars per participant. And then there is another class of interventions that basically facilitate job search. These very often are very small fixes, things like workshops to help people develop clearer CVs, tips on how to better present your skills to prospective employers, standardized tests to document those skills, for example, or maybe small financial incentives and small financial support to support job search. And some of these interventions can actually be very cheap. So now we're talking, it's an order of magnitude lower, not $400 per participant, but maybe $40 per participant. And at least in terms of impacts on employment, we know on beneficiaries, we know that those interventions are often successful. So there is a recent meta-analysis, for example, looking at the impacts of certification interventions, so different interventions that try to document skills, and those tend to have on average about a 3 percentage point effect on employment. So that's about half of your average effect of a training intervention, but for 1/10 of the cost. Just in terms of raw cost effectiveness per beneficiary, they seem to be a much better deal. Now, there is a catch or a potential catch, and this potential catch is that we still do not know, and this is also true of training intervention, what happens to people who are not treated, to the people who are not beneficiaries of these interventions. I'm quite agnostic about this. I think people intuitively suspect that training interventions will have no or weaker impacts on non-beneficiaries compared to the search interventions. I'm not sure. I guess the jury's out on this one. We need the evidence. But it is possible that some of these interventions are achieving these gains at the cost of other job seekers in the labor market, not securing those jobs. And so the net gains on employment are lower than the gains that we can document with this type of trials. In my mind, in a sense, the key driver of this negative effect in the short run is the share of vacancies that go unfilled. If you're in a labor market that is very tight, where almost no vacancy go unfilled, well, then it's almost guaranteed that anything that you do that raises somebody's employment will come at the cost of somebody else that doesn't get their job. We know that that's not the case in lots of the labor markets where we work in. There are lots of vacancies that go unfilled. So it's possible that some of these gains are generally net gains in employment, but we simply do not have the systematic evidence to quantify the size of those net gains. We just know the gains for the beneficiaries, not the net gains to the economy.
Don't you guys think that it's a lot of a problem about the trials always being done at the individual level? That is, if we trialed training interventions at the market level, then we could also measure the positive externalities. Because as Stefano correctly said, it depends on the vacancies. If the vacancies are fixed, then it's one in, one out. But if many people get trained, maybe a new firm will open because now they have a sufficient number of welders. Now, the theme of the podcast is welders, to open a welding factory, right? And I think that all those big externalities are missed out because all the evidence we have is within a market.
And from the sort of practitioner's perspective, sometimes I have this, not necessarily frustration with any particular team, but sort of in general frustration with myself, let's say, in the sectors that these vocational skills are really unimaginative, right? It's this sort of really traditional for women, tailoring, maybe hairdressing, in some local context, or, welding, carpentry, etc. And then sort of new innovative stuff would be something to do with freelancing, some graphics design, etc. So those are the innovations. But otherwise, everything is stuck in the same sectors. In terms of new employment, if we could, let's say there is a missing market or a missing sector, and we have created a missing sector by addressing this problem, And then at the same time, working on the demand side, some sort of coordination failure has been addressed. And we see these new people employed in these new sectors, then we are fairly confident these are all new employments. There is no displacement as such. But we don't have that type of integrated interventions as such. And I do have one sector in mind where I think there's a lot of scope is around the care economy. So be it childcare or nursing, there is a lot of demand around it, but there are not that many training being provided. And then all these other market failures, like how do you know the quality assurance and et cetera, credit constraint would come in.
I feel there's a paper coming here. Stefano's worked on evaluating the effect of care for children, because here the externality is huge. Because if you set up a recognized childcare sector, then you free all the women's labor. So it's transformative, really. But this is an intervention, again, that you must do at the market level.
And going back, I really like mentioning that you mentioned coordination, because in my original list of the reasons why you may want to provide training, I did not include that. It's clearly part of a big reason why in many contexts you may want to intervene and subsidize training. It's not just that workers cannot afford it or firms do not provide it because of fear of losing workers. It's also that in some cases you just need to coordinate the demand and the supply of labor. And if you don't do that, there are just missing markets. I guess the green economy is another area where I suspect this may be happening in some places. So, for example, there is a lot of interest and a lot of push from governments to expand into solar, when lots of countries have lots of sun. Abundant opportunity to develop the solar energy sector, and yet perhaps workers are not quite aware of those opportunities. They're a bit myopic. Businesses that try to move into that space struggle to find a qualified labor, and so you just have these sectors not developing. I was struck, I just mentioned one example. Morocco wants to place itself as one of the green energy powerhouses of the world, and they are laying cables in the Mediterranean to export green energy to Europe. By the way, whilst their own energy is produced with fossil fuels still, because they will help balance Europe's carbon footprint. But anyways, that's one more paradox there. But in any case, they're investing very heavily in the production, and they've opened, I think, the largest solar power plant in the world in the desert. But their training sector, which is very big, so they invest a lot in training, doesn't have green skills at all in the curriculum. And there is very little interest among workers and very little. And these are technologies that would require a fair amount of labor for maintenance, for installation.
Of course. There is also the issue that, talking about coordination, very often in low-income countries, these programs are offered by NGOs. And the NGOs do not coordinate between themselves. So you may end up with a market where an NGO trains welders, another trains hairdressers, and so there is not enough to open a welding business or a hairdressing business because everybody's trained into something different by NGOs who do not coordinate.
That's a great point. And so I wonder, since we have highlighted some of the problems with the way vocational training is currently being handled, including what Oriana just mentioned, NGOs working in silos, and we've highlighted a few areas where new opportunities are emerging, like caregiving and like the green economy, I wonder what hopes or advice you have as these programs are starting from the ground up as to how to better design them. And Stefano, I wonder if you can share a little bit more about the paper Oriana mentioned, where you're looking at caregiving specifically.
Sure. I mean, in that case, it's more a paper about the absence of a market than a paper about the existence of a market. So in Egypt, female labor force participation is very low. And in particular, there are large child penalties or marriage penalties, really. And so when you look at the employment rates of mothers, it's extremely low. And a childcare sector, the formal childcare sector, is also not very well developed, as you can imagine, because the two things kind of reinforce one another. So the government in Egypt was interested in promoting the use of formal childcare among mothers in relatively low-income neighborhood to see whether that could actually boost employment. It's actually a relatively well-established finding that in other contexts, so not contexts that have such low female labor force participation as Egypt, but in countries in sub-Saharan Africa, where there is an employment gap between men and women, but it's not as large, or in South America, in those contexts, offering childcare, maybe subsidizing childcare, and so on, that typically, reliably, has a fairly large effect on female labor force participation, or female employment. In Egypt, however, there is a concourse of things that made it actually, in our trial, actually quite ineffective. So what we did in the trial was offering vouchers to use these NGO run nurseries mostly that the government wanted to promote. They were kind of pilot projects or in the early days, and they wanted to make sure that more people would access these nurseries. And there is a concourse of things that made the intervention particularly ineffective. One thing that is related to these markets for childcare is that the opening hours of these nurseries were actually not great. So rather than having a system where you could leave your child for maybe 8-9 hours and have all the time to reach any job in a big labor market around your house and then come back without stress, the hours were so compressed that basically that already cut out a number of jobs. Even given that, it's still surprising how little interest there was in the nurseries, and that's down to a combination of conservative social norms. But social norms are also very heterogeneous, so there were lots of women that did not subscribe to those norms. So we interviewed the husbands, and the husbands were okay, both with employment and nurseries. And so finally, the final barrier, at least in that paper, seems to be non-pecuniary job amenities. So the aspects of jobs, they're not really related to money, but are related to, you know, the flexibility of employment. Some of these are related to the non-pecuniary benefits like health insurance or other forms of insurance that you get. Some of these are related to the work environment. But basically, the bundle of things that jobs, once you cut, given the nursery hours and given how much I can commute and so on and so forth, the remaining jobs were typically fairly unattractive blue-collar jobs. The mothers were, they were just not a good match for the mothers in our sample. So there is a missing market. And I guess if nurseries offered longer hours, better care, and so on, it would be a more promising intervention in this context.
This is actually quite common in high-income countries as well. Most evaluations of nursery programs find no effects. And then when you go and look at the hours, they offer 3 hours of childcare. What you're going to do in 3 hours? You can't even do a part-time job.
Right. So something that BRAC has been scheming that could be of interest. So it's basically something learned from how people are organizing it informally. So in the urban central Dhaka and peri-urban areas where there are lots of garments workers, many of them have to leave their jobs because of childcare. When they have babies, they have to leave the jobs. They still sort of no maternity leave. And what we observed there is often these mothers start keeping other children and they started their own mini, we are calling it home-based childcare. So it's happening. I mean, there are similar models in India. I think it's called Anganwadi worker. So things of that sort, very informal, home-based, low-cost. So what BRAC is trying to do is basically check if there is essentially a coordination problem, that there are other mothers who would like to keep children, but the biggest problem for them or biggest constraint for them is trust. Do we trust that person with my child? Starting from the point of, you know, that I will find my child back, of course, and then sort of all sorts of care, etc. So we are doing a little RCT around it, but when we try to create kind of a cluster where we identify one potential entrepreneur who would work as a childcare provider and connect them with some mothers, and we are observing, I mean, these are just anecdotes, we'll have more solid evidence in a year or so. We found some of the mothers were like, yeah, this is a good idea. Why don't I become the entrepreneur? And so we have found a few of the mothers who had intended to be the users of this service have become the providers of this service. So it's sort of, I think, 3 or 4 cases out of 150 clusters, but points to the fact that there's probably just a simple coordination failure of bringing them together and figuring out, hey, there's this need and you can work out a way of meeting this service need.
Munshi, one follow-up for you. You were just providing a window into some emerging work at BRAC, and you mentioned that you would have more solid evidence in a year or so. Can you tell me more about how BRAC looks at evidence as it does this work on vocational training? And to what extent do you work with the world of development economics and the world of research as you're rolling these programs out?
There are two types of evidence in BRAC programming. You know, we can call it big E, small E, certified evidence, uncertified evidence. So there's always lots of iterations going on based on programmatic feedback. As they see something not working out the way they intended, they keep tweaking. So let's call it the uncertified evidence. Sometimes these are documented as sort of simple process documentation way or just through a cross-sectional survey of sorts. But every once in a while, BRAC comes up with a model, they feel like, okay, this is well designed enough that can be tested. It's not context proof, but it's general enough that can be adapted relatively easily in different contexts. So EPG is one of the examples. Then we also had the Empowerment and Livelihood for Adolescent and then vocational training, several models around it. We form partnerships. We have been working with LSE and Oriana for over 20 years now. We have panels going back as far as back 20 years. So it's basically there are a lot of internal iterative running and then at some point feeling confident enough that we can go for a more solid impact evaluation so that out of the evaluation, we don't come out as a conclusion that it didn't work because we didn't implement it right. Just to minimize that type of implementation failure, diluting the results so that we have more evidence on the model. And then from BRAC's perspective, time frame is 2, 3, 4 years. But of course, for us researchers, once we start something, we want to keep looking at it over longer and longer term as much as possible.
I think I can bring an example of when BRAC had figured out the implementation perfectly and we went and tampered with it. Well, we didn't voluntarily tamper with it, but in a paper with Stefan and Munshi, we were looking at the question, trying to go deeper into the problem, as Stefan was mentioning earlier, what is the constraint that these programs are trying to solve? And so we went to the, I guess, the most straightforward that we could think of, which is liquidity constraints. Maybe training doesn't reach enough people because the people can't afford it. And so we worked with BRAC with a program called Prosper, which is one of the flagship training programs. BRAC continued to do their selection. In addition, we did a census of all the people in a catchment area, and we offered the training on a pay-if-employed basis and on a heavily discounted basis. And after all that work, nothing worked. Take-up was very low, and those who did do the training didn't benefit at all. So then we thought, either the program doesn't work, but I don't think so, because if BRAC is convinced and they gave it to us to evaluate, they probably implement it correctly, or we really selected the wrong people. And so we went and see the people that BRAC would select. We replicated that in our sample, and we find the standard effect in the literature. We find the 5% increase. Now, if you look at the people, it makes it look really terrible for BRAC, because they are men, younger, without children, and from richer families, which at face value is not great. But then if you think about it, the others are way too poor. It's like giving admission to Oxford to somebody who hasn't done high school. It looks good because the person is poor. Maybe it's a woman. Maybe it's a woman of an ethnic minority. But if you don't have the right preparation, that cannot be an effect. And that's, again, a poverty trap.
This gets directly to something I wanted to hear from each of you on. Who benefits the most from vocational training and who is left behind? I wonder if you can talk about some of the challenges of training programs effectively reaching women, youth, rural populations, and what are some approaches that have been effective or what more is needed in this regard?
Well, maybe let me start with a couple of considerations based on the paper that Oriana just referred to and the project that Oriana just referred to. If you look at the dimensions of selection that really made our sample distinct from the sample that BRAC would usually select, a couple of ideas as to how the key challenges that the poorer people face to participate in training programs become evident. One is this idea that Oriana was saying, which is related to background or starting human capital. So training programs assume a certain level of starting human capital and build on it. But of course, if you miss the foundation, it's hard to build on something that is not solid. But on top of that, there are other things that stand out that could potentially be big barriers. So for example, childcare. That's not really related necessarily to background human capital, how much you know, or how much you can build upon, but it's related to the opportunity cost of time. How much time you've got available to spend on training at the moment, how much time you have to focus. And one challenge, certainly of that program, but of many training programs worldwide, is also absenteeism. Your child, maybe you have some informal childcare arrangement, allows you to attend some days, but some days the person in the neighborhood that is taking care of your child has to do something else, and so you cannot attend that class. So that clearly decreases the amount of learning that you can do. Also, we found that there was an age dimension to this, which again points to an interesting trade-off, because there are, of course, new technologies that I'm quite hopeful can be applied to training to really increase its responsiveness to firms' needs and its effectiveness more broadly. But it will cut out the people who are just not IT literate and able to interact with these technologies effectively.
Coming to the point of equity, you have to really be careful about what the alternative is. Because in our case, training people who cannot benefit from the training is an enormous waste of money. So it might look unequal to focus on younger men without children for richer families, but that's not wasted money. So you always have to think about the counterfactual. If the counterfactual is offering training to people who don't benefit, then it's better to just focus on those who benefit, no doubt. If the counterfactual is investing in another program that helps those people, then it's a whole different problem.
Do you see that happening, Oriana, where you know there are groups training people for jobs that don't exist?
Yeah, we see it all the time.
So in our questionnaires, we did include some questions that actually asked potential trainees about their views on these trade-offs, not just in terms of their moral views, but whether they thought that actually such a trade-off existed in practice, whether they thought that the poorer would benefit more or less from these kind of programs. And actually, we found fairly consistent evidence from people's responses that they believe that such a trade-off actually exists. So they believe that these training programs tend to be more effective for people, for example, who already have previous work experience. And even better, if they have some work experience in that specific sector. Or another dimension too, there is this consistent pattern that they just believe that having an initial better position in the labor market actually makes you more able to gain rather than less able to gain. So it seems to be that in their mental model of how training operates, that trade-off is also implicit, that if you want to reach the poorest, you are going to have to accept lower gains. At least in that Bangladesh experiment that we are talking about, that was so extreme that the gains were basically close to zero. So at that point, there is also no trade-off anymore because there is also no equity gain to try to be more progressive. I suspect in other cases, you will find a more nuanced trade-off where the poorer will gain just less. And so there, it's a hard decision to have to make.
I have a question for Munshi now, because I think most donors look at the number of people trained as an outcome. And we are super successful. We tripled, quadrupled the number of people trained because we offer it for free. So people come and check it. And so using number of people treated might not be the smartest thing to do, right? But is that true, Munshi, that donors tend to focus on the number of people trained?
That's there, but then also sometimes like a number of male versus female and some additional disaggregation on the output level to have a sense of equity. It's sometimes there, but I think it misses out the fundamental point of what are we trying to address. I see some parallel to microfinance and ultra-poor graduation here. So we have this vocational training as a solution, and let's try and do this where we can get the best impact. That's one question, which is different from those who are the sort of poorest or sort of most vulnerable. What can we do that will benefit them? And vocational training may not be in that package, or maybe it may be there, but there are certain preconditions before that. That conversation, I feel, is missing.
So I think it's such a great point talking about how part of the problem here is that donors are looking at the number of people trained as an outcome. And Oriana mentioned earlier that we see it all the time that people are being trained for jobs that don't exist. Whether it is women, for example, who might not have the same access to opportunities, or also jobs that might be going away. So the nature of work is changing. We all know that. I'm sure this comes up a lot in your work and in your research, whether it's digital transformation, automation. So I wonder, Munshi, I don't know if you can speak to some of your work with BRAC on this, or also curious to hear from Oriana or Stefano from a research lens, how does the changing nature of work lead to necessary changes in vocational training?
I think Munshi touched on this briefly earlier, when he said we keep training welders, but we don't need that much welding after all. And there's very few creative jobs.
That's right. I think there's another level which is leapfrogging from one set of skills that is needed to at a higher level. So from 6 months training, so something that needs a lot more training, maybe completely different types of equipment, etc. Those leapfrogs are also often missing. And so all the firms, everyone is caught in this low productive equilibrium, not making that shift. And just training one or two with that high level skill while the equipments are not there. You know, some of our friends, colleagues sort of did similar work in Uganda will not address this problem. So it's not to say that, you know, the skills gap is not there, but the way we're trying to address this or exactly how much we are addressing is not making a meaningful change, actually. And personally, I mean, from things that I've observed and narratives I had versus the evidence that I've seen changed my narrative. Vocational is one of the cases. I was a big believer of apprenticeship because I thought it's cheaper, they're hands-on, they get hired by the same employer. It's just obvious it's better than vocational skill. But when we did this experiment in Uganda with Oriana and others, we saw that, yes, in the short run, it does look like much better. But as we track over time, things completely reverse.
It's a very important theme, I think, looking in the long run, because most evaluations are done in 1 or 2 years, but some interventions take time to show the real value. And in the case that Munshi was mentioning, the apprenticeship was fantastic to start with because the person was employed in the same firm. But once they lost their job, that was it because it was very specific to that firm. Whereas the vocational training people took some more time to find a job, but once they did, they could move from job to job because they had their certificate.
The VoxDev Lit on barriers to search and hiring in urban labor markets highlights how skill building has to go hand in hand with policies that reduce job search barriers and improve hiring systems how do we get there? I think you're all in agreement that that is the best way forward. How does that happen?
This question is an institutional question. Who is offering different programs? And in fact, there is an even earlier transition, which is from social protection to active labor market policies. And I find sometimes, because we tend to work in silos a little bit, we just develop a partnership with one set of people in one ministry, one unit, or one NGO, and then we specialize in one program, is the transitions that we miss. But I guess there is real a need, and I find it every time that I talk to policymakers or that I engage in policy-focused institutions like JPAL or the IGC to understand these transitions better. So we know something about, okay, how do we help people when they are in extreme poverty through transfers? What does that do? But then we know something about training, but we don't think about the transition. Then again, the job search part. So I suspect bigger partnerships and are the solution, because you really would need to interact with the different people in government or different people even in the same NGO that would be dealing with different products. I think that this is the case in BRAC too, for example. BRAC is one organization, but there are kind of different parts of the organization that deal with different products. Even the people that do microfinance are not the same people who do ultra full graduation, and the two can be connected, but there are some friction in the connection. So it's there in these liminal interstitial spaces, probably some of the biggest gains going ahead.
Coordination is the name of the game. I mean, we have to understand how to do interventions at the market level and how to evaluate them, because there are not so many markets that you can run a randomized control trial with 1,000 markets, 500 in control, 500 in treatment. So we have to be a bit more clever in finding out ways of evaluating market level interventions, because I think otherwise we dismiss treatments that could be perfectly valid, like vocational training in a new skill, simply because we treat too few people for that to generate a market.
More evidence generation, that's good for our business. But I think at the practitioner's level, I see often stuck in the same type of narrative that we do vocational training, then we do a survey 6 months later to see how they're doing. Oh, they're doing great. Okay, let's move on. Another batch 6 months later. Get out of these cycles and think about the marginal value of additional evidence and where we have the best value for evidence.
Well, that's why conversations like this one are very important to have. So, Oriana, Stefano, Munshi, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks a lot.
That's all for this episode of Development Dialogues. If you'd like to learn more about the Economic Growth Center, you can visit egc.yale.edu, where you can sign up for the EGC newsletter. And if you'd like to learn more about VoxDev, head to voxdev.org, where you can sign up for the VoxDev newsletter and receive a weekly summary of the latest economic research. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and consider sharing it and leaving a rating and review. And look for the next installment of Development Dialogues wherever you get your podcasts.